Coming up on Tech Nation, MIT professor Sherry Turkle, known best for her work on the psychological relationship between humans and technology. Her latest book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. We'll look at the psychological effect of this difficult presidential election. Then on Biotech Nation, diagnosing some behavioral problems and mental disorders in the pediatric area by testing the immune system. Dr. Craig Shimasaki, the CEO of Molecular Labs, explains their test and the science behind it. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Back in my NASA days when videotaping first became available, the Institute decided it would videotape its important meetings. The very first time the camera and tripod was set up at one regularly scheduled meeting, a very strange thing happened. One person, we'll call him Joe, was a naturally ebullient, talkative, contributive person. Well, Joe suddenly clammed up. When finally asked directly for his input, Joe simply brushed the question away with a hand signal. Finally, when we broke for coffee, we asked him, "Hey, Joe, what gives?" And he had a short speech at the ready. "I am respectfully refusing to be recorded. It can be used by anyone and everyone for who knows what purpose in some future time. I don't want to impact anyone else, but I won't be recorded." Two or three meetings went by this way, and the burden of having to obtain and store all the videotapes, the cost of the crew, and the fact that no one really cared, and suddenly the videotaping was stopped. Joe went back to his old self, and the video cameras were never referenced again. Joe had simply created a policy for himself and stuck to it. What Joe did was a protest of silence with a very small but personally meaningful footprint. The parallels to the silent protest of Colin Kaepernick are clear. Kaepernick decided not to stand while the national anthem was played during the National Football League games, and suddenly someone noticed. Took them a few times to catch on, and finally when asked, he explained that his protest was about his perception of racial injustice and oppression in the United States, especially police brutality. But unlike Joe, the world was watching. Immediate and widespread criticism exploded. Even Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called it dumb and disrespectful, while other professional athletes and even amateur ones began to take up the protest as well. The information footprint created by interconnected media of all sorts is global and instantaneous. A man sits on a football field. A public comment is made thousands of miles away at a different time, and days later, a Supreme Court justice issues an apology. This was unimaginable in earlier times. While that's the bare bones of the technical capability, what happened next was telling. Within days, Justice Ginsburg issued an apology, saying that her words were inappropriately dismissive and harsh. And when asked about the apology, Kaepernick got the more important point right, about what it means to make a quiet, personal protest, especially an unpopular one. Kaepernick pointed to Justice Bader's original assertion, which called his protest dumb. Doing so, he said, delegitimizes it. And delegitimizing is what the powers that be always do to quiet a voice, to negate the power of individual action. So look around you, and you'll see delegitimizing everywhere, and not just in protests. I recall having one of my interviews unexpectedly reveal the fabrication of a Silicon Valley CEO. When brought to light by major mainstream media, The first two internet responses were, one, that it didn't matter as long as the CEO could do his job, and two, what a terrible interviewer I was. It took me several days before I realized that these responses were planted by the CEO's PR department. It was intentional delegitimization through and through, including me, suggesting if my questions were better, the CEO would not have fabricated his credentials. So next time you see it, look around. Who or what is the target and why? I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, MIT professor Sherry Turkle talks about the psychology of our relationship with technology, with special emphasis on the presidential election season of 2016. Her book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Then on Biotech Nation, in the pediatric area, can we trace some behavioral issues and some mental disorders to problems with the immune system? I'll speak with Dr. Craig Shimasaki, the CEO of Molecular Labs. On the cover of Dr. Sherry Turkle's book, Reclaiming Conversation, there are two empty chairs facing each other, which makes sense. How could there be a conversation of one?
There is a conversation of one. The two chairs are on the cover because I think most people think of conversation as happening with two. But the message of the book really comes from Thoreau, who said in his cabin he had three chairs, one for solitude, two for friendship, and three for society. And really the takeaway from this book is that we need to attend to a crisis in all three kinds of conversation in our culture now. The conversations we have with ourselves, do we still know in our age of constant connection how to be alone? The kinds of conversations we have with each other, do we know how to attend fully to each other? And then the three chairs of society, how is digital connection hurting and as well as helping our conversations as a society?
Well, on a superficial or high level that we all have experienced that have ever touched email, it goes awry, misinterpreted, reused in another way, sent under the influence of intoxicants.
Yes.
We know digital communications, once sent, they don't go away. There's no arguments of, I really said this. No, I said, no, it's right here.
Right. Well, in Reclaiming, I discuss at length the way in which the experience of sending an email, you're alone very often, you're facing this phosphorescent screen, you have a sense of intimacy and connection with that screen, you feel alone in a kind of bubble in deep psychic ways, and you let down your guard and you feel protected, and everything about the experience of sending electronic communication is at odds with the reality of electronic communication. You are not alone. It is forever. It is going to be read by people other than the person it is intended for. And the same thing with what we do when we're in chat rooms or when we're on social media.
We're texting each other.
You know, that the feeling is that it is the most intimate place to play with words and be obnoxious, but to hope you're understood. No. You're not. It's really not. And I think that perhaps this election, where you see how an office environment, instead of talking to each other face-to-face, use the email as a place to share easily misunderstood communications. You know, here's my risotto, and hey, well, shut down this nonsense. What a mistake we made, and here's a recipe. You know, I think that offices of not just political offices, but offices of all kinds are going to be, and institutions of all kinds are going to be perhaps looking again at what to put in email and what not.
We're going to talk about the current political situation. This is recorded the Friday before the big Tuesday,
right.
You know, and I had to laugh. I had an affair last night.
Exactly.
But
this is exactly, but that's exactly, you would type me an email. I was at an affair, you know, I was at an affair. And it would just be like
affair.
It would just be spliced out affair last night, you know, and then I'd be off and running with this. And there you go.
Yeah, there you go. And the joke is so-and-so was out of the country and
right.
wouldn't get back until very late on Tuesday night. And they said, can you imagine? He could wake up on Wednesday morning and a female could be president and the Cubs won the World Series.
It's right.
Like, oh, right. No, this can't be true. It's a whole new world.
Right,
so
exactly.
So the perspective of what's going on today
right.
and how it goes on. I mean, we've had 3 presidential debates, 1 town hall, 2 debates. With technology, we can see all these debates and re-see them or see snippets as editors choose and on whatever area we have. We can see what each candidate has to say about everyone and anybody out of context. I'm going here with all the stretch of technology here. The level of name-calling and beyond name-calling we have, the calling for targeted action now and post-election. We have facts and factoids. We have absolute fabrications presented as facts. The theft and slow release of the campaign staffer's email. All of these things are unprecedented. We had a past in which if somebody got a fact wrong, the media would jump on them. The fact would be created. Then everybody mm-hmm. talked about the fact that, you know, a precise thing of how it used to be is that poor guy who didn't know what Aleppo was.
Right.
Made one mistake. Didn't know Aleppo. We
right.
told him what Aleppo was. Then everybody
finished.
Ground on. Yeah, got to grind on it until the next thing we could jump on. You can't do that with this much here. Can you try to break down? I know this is not totally aspects are in the book. Can you break down for us psychologically the effect of all of this media coming at us in various ways while, as you very clearly point out, we frequently only want to choose to listen to what we want to listen to.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's so much in your question. One of the things that strikes me is that when people have so much, it's like I call it the paradox of choice is what this is called. When people have so much coming at them, very often they simplify and they just can't deal with the fact, for example, that every day you learn something new about Donald Trump. I mean, yesterday I learned 4 new things about his business dealings, I mean, the overseas, how he handles his taxes, you know, the family thing. And people just say, and in some ways, it's easier to focus on like emails as a kind, people take a sort of, you know,
what can I understand?
What can I understand about Hillary Clinton? Emails, crook, email, you know, that there's sort of a, Clinton Foundation emails crook. You know that in a way the massive information. You know, is he linked with Putin? Is it, where are his investments? You know, what about the women? The massive information really does become an overload. So that's the first thing. That sometimes what we've learned about the internet is that too much information has not necessarily. On a very super, you know, kind of process superficially, quickly, a pundit a day has not helped us understand things deeply necessarily and has been confusing for a lot of people. Secondly, we do live in a media bubble. And a second way people deal with this is they silo, and the internet helps them silo, what they learn and what they hear. So your Facebook, your social media, your information pages give you basically what it knows you want to know. It gives you what
it's programmed to do that.
It's programmed to do that. The algorithms are programmed to do that. So this works in very, very specific ways. It only gives you information on shoes that it knows you want to buy. It only gives you information on clothes and the price point that it knows you're interested in. And if you veer out of the price point, it will start to tell you about a whole new price point because you have now opened the algorithm up to Hermes, you know?
As a journalist and researcher, I go through so much. You should see the junk that is advertised to me. No. I just was going to do an interview about this and this aspect.
Exactly.
Suddenly you want to buy something here.
Exactly. And so you can really trace how the portrait of the internet you're getting. But it also means that if a candidate knows that you're pro-gun, but has an anti-gun position, you will not get that information in what that candidate feeds you. If that candidate has in the materials you get about that candidate, let's say in a local election, they can send you everything else about that candidate except what might upset you about that candidate.
Well, in the old days, you could only do television.
Right.
And so you had to kind of take a bet on the populace. Well, most of these people, in the case of pro-gun,
right,
1N, pro-gun,
right,
most of these people are going to go for that. So we've got to take a calculated risk.
Right.
Now with targeted abilities,
right,
it's like, okay, I know you're pro-gun, so we'll include that here. I know you're anti.
Exactly.
Same with pro-choice, pro-life.
Exactly.
You go down any of the dividers.
Right.
So they get picked out.
Right. So the second point I was making is this sort of siloing of what you see and the narrowing of what you see, and that you don't really get exposed even to the truth about everybody, the reality of everybody, or the other side. And the reason this, I want to just take off a minute on the second point about not seeing the reality of the other side, is one of the studies that I cite in Reclaiming Conversation is one that was done of college students who say that they would not want to have a political conversation with someone who doesn't agree with them, even if that person – this is not on the internet. This is how the internet has affected
yes.
the rest of our life. Even if that person lived down the hall from them in college. So even if they share a bathroom, they would not want to get into a conversation about anything that touched on this area of disagreement. And when you interview them and you say, well, why not? They say, I just don't want to go there. I don't like confrontation. And then they say, and I also don't know how to. And I think that's one of the things that I was really able to trace in this book is that it's both that we do. It's so much is going on. We don't like to. We're not getting good at it. We're used to just typing at each other our disagreements. A generation is really growing up that is not good at really kind of rational discussion and is not being given leadership. I mean, I would add that is teaching them this. So this siloing effect is being played out in national discourse and in personal discourse in very discomforting ways because democracy really does need people talking to each other. There's a wonderful, I cite, the things that were said of the 18th century coffee houses in England, said to be the seat of democracy, that people used to go there in order to talk to people they disagreed with. That was their virtue. That is not what we're using the internet for now. And that is a great virtue.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Sherry Turkle, known best for her in-depth work in the psychology of people's relationship with technology. She's the Abby Rockefeller Mose Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. The author of numerous books, her studies into digital culture include The Second Self, Life on the Screen, and alone today. A fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, she's here today with Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. Well, one characteristic of a narcissist, as an example, is that if you challenge them, they get mad and they're going to come back at you. They're angry. Well, that's one thing to have a few narcissists in the crowd. But let's not mistake that for people with the inability to mediate. Someone's just told me something that's diametrically opposed to what I'm saying or what I'm thinking, and I can't deal with it.
Well, again, you know, I think at the beginning of this election, I was called to the Commission on Presidential Debates to have them to have a discussion about how to make the debates more civil.
You've got to be kidding.
No, it was actually, I've written
Forgive
about,
me, that's
I,
funny.
I wrote about this on a blog for the London Review of Books, and it. I didn't mean for it to be funny. I meant for this to be a very poignant piece, but people read the piece in the London Review and say it's hysterically funny. And
Having seen all the debates.
Well, right. The point I make is that the commission was trying to think about how they would civilize the internet because, you know, people would show bad behavior on the internet around the debates. But in fact, I think what we learned from the debates is that the mores of the internet, the fact that people go into a chat room, are anonymous sometimes and just, spew whatever.
Yeah.
That the Twitter, that the kind of dark side of Twitter culture really has come into our political discourse, that the internet has leaked into how we talk to each other. The internet has leaked into our conversation, not how can we tamp down the internet, but how can we reclaim our conversation to have rules of discourse that were better for our democratic process, because we've allowed the internet too much to take over how we talk to each other. And one of the things, just bringing it down really to how kids are growing up, one of the things that I see in my research is that, for example, children don't know how to apologize to each other because they've gotten used to a world where they say, "I'm sorry," and hit send. That's
like 1/7 of an apology at our house.
When you think about when people say to me, well, what's so special about face-to-face? Why do you need face-to-face? What's wrong? Well, it's because this is a simple, homely example of why you need face-to-face. It's not that I like to say I'm not anti-technology. I'm just pro-conversation. I know the work that conversation can do. That when you're in a conversation, and it actually voice conversation is very rich. I mean, I think it's face-to-face is wonderful, but voice, the power of voice. I mean, we're on the radio. People get a sense of a person in voice. It's extremely intimate and powerful. So much is going on to learn empathy. My grandmother used to say, don't apologize if you're not contrite enough. It won't work. You have to hear if the other person is contrite enough, and then you have to be sensitive to that, and then they have to hear or see in your face whether you are really ready to have an opening for change. There's a real dance of intention and readiness and to then construct something new. Now, none of that, and all of that is about building up a sense of empathy. We're built to do that, but you need practice. And none of that is going to happen with "I'm sorry" and hitting send.
I'm fascinated by what you say, because it dovetails exactly with the rules of apology in our house, and we started formulating them when as very little boys, one went to the other and said, "Oh, sorry, you're not sorry at all. You're young, but we're going to have to work on this." And it's like you've got to precisely identify what it is you did,
right,
what you perceived to be the effect on the other person, and how that hurt them. try to explain why you did it and how you're not going to get yourself in that position again. Some bells can't be unrung. So are you going to do something that might make up for it in some symbolic way? And then finally, you get to say a sincere apology, and maybe they will forgive you. But what it does is it opens you up for compassion and empathy.
This is Yom Kippur.
Yes, it's Yom Kippur. See, being raised Roman Catholic, I never would have known this. You know,
right.
So it's like explaining this. You know, you say, "Oh, I'm not." You'll be 7 or 8 years old and go, "Well, I need to." You know, "Well, I'm sorry. Oh, wait a minute. Have I done everything?" It's like, no. You've got to work on this harder. But layering on this, the psychological and expressive and all those things that are telltales beyond words, putting them together and saying sometimes there are not words there, but one can sense and understand that.
Yes. And this is the kind of thing that over-reliance in development on digital communication doesn't help with. So when people talk about, how old children should be when they're online, and there's not hard and fast rules. What there is a sensitivity to what we're talking about now. There are baby bouncers with a slot for an iPad. There are potty trainers with a slot for an iPad. The reason that those things are the reasons that there needs to be a consumer movement, and I'm very strong on this, that the place we're at now and the feeling that I have about this book as opposed to previous things I've written that have been critical of the internet is that we're ready now to build a consumer movement that takes a stand about the kind of digital culture we want. That 89% of Americans say that they took out a digital device, a phone, usually during their last social encounter, and 82% said that it diminished the conversation. So we're ready to say we know more about what kind of digital life would help us, and it's time for us to work with industry, and it's time for us to actually organize and make together a better digital life, a life that will be more satisfying and more helpful to us. I mean, we'll just say one more thing about the politics that was very dramatic. I spoke at a Midwestern university, and I did speak a little bit about the election and this, and I noted, and I some thoughts about free speech and some thoughts about the importance of, you know, in having an election that glorified it and never having one that interfered with it. And after my talk, I was told, "Well, that was pretty dark." And I said, "Well, no, I think this election really, the kind of insult culture of this election and has not helped us in a democratic, have a democratic, the kind of election that is good for democracy."
I've been speaking with MIT professor Sherry Turkle, the author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, in the pediatric area, can problems with the immune system be reflected in behavioral problems or mental disorder? We'll hear from Dr. Craig Shimasaki, the CEO of Molecular Labs. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Sherry Turkle, the author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age.
The kind of insult culture of this election and has not helped us in a democratic, have a democratic kind of election that is good for democracy. And I was told that things had gotten so polarized on that campus that there kind of had been an understanding to not talk about this.
Yeah.
You know, no signs up, just to chill, that this was a kind of taboo subject. And I think that is something that is very interesting, that potentially I could see becoming more and more part of our life in this country, that people become both so divided and feel that the chasm between them is so unbridgeable and so frightened of that their communication is not secure, they have no privacy, that they just become – they're silenced. They're silenced, and you really don't have the kind of discourse you need to have. Even in Reclaiming Conversation, which was written before this election stuff started, I talk to young people who feel that because they have no privacy, they say, it's good that I don't have any controversial ideas because – if I did, it would be I would have to express them on the internet where there's no privacy, and so it's good that I don't have anything controversial to say. So they silence themselves because they don't want to express themselves in the one medium that they can. Or a young woman says to me, "Who would care about me and my little life?" as a way of justifying her feelings of not having any privacy. That is not an empowering mantra. So I think that we, in the political area, we need to do a lot of work to refine our political voices and to rediscover what democracy is going to be in this area, in this time of this so much information. Because the dream that having the information all coming to us on the internet would just by itself would create a more democratic, a democratic utopian world, that has turned out not to be true.
I'm very touched by your description of the insult culture. I touched on it earlier with the name calling and calling for actions and things along that line. There, with families, with groups you're trying to manage, you know, with even with companies. When one permits bad behavior, we can talk about the effect of that. But where I'm really going with this is when one crosses the line, any relationship can say, look, you crossed the line. How do you get back? Many times say, I can't get back. Never working for that company again. Never having that friend again. Those choices. And now I feel like we may be close to that, or elements of that are true, about our society, mm-hmm. that it has created in the last 6 months, you know, especially in the last few months, a polarization that these people may not be able to come together again. Whole swaths of people may always, in our lifetime, mm-hmm. treat the other with disdain. How do you bring those people together again, created by this sort of insult fabrication culture?
Well, you know, we don't have any choice but to be hopeful. I mean, if we care about living in a democracy, there is no choice but to say we have to rebuild it. Because the options are well-known options. It's not as though we don't know the alternatives to reclaiming our democracy. We know the authoritarian options. We know the fascistic options. We know
history.
History has taught us all the options to this being a Weimar moment, to this being a Mussolini moment. I mean, we know the options. And, you know, I was just reading something, I'm forgetting the author right now, but who said, you know, this country went through the Depression. And managed to hold on to the Constitution. You know, buffeted, bruised. We did. And we need to hold on to that as we go through this moment of tremendous disruption. A lot of things are happening. And find a way to go through this moment and hold on to this very fragile set of institutions. I mean, you see how fragile. Let the Supreme Court have 8 justices, 7, 6, 5.
What does it matter?
It's just, you know, I mean, you just see how you can destroy checks and balances. I mean, you can, by saying, well, that really, there's really no judicial thing that just really belongs to the Senate. That was really just a Senate thing. You see how fragile these institutions are. And I think that Americans of my generation grew up thinking post-Second World War children grew up thinking these institutions were very robust. And I think that what we've been humbled by this election. Anyone who's looking at this coolly into seeing how fragile these institutions are. And not just this election, but really, but this last Obama presidency, I think, has shown us how fragile these institutions are. And I would say it's a time to redouble efforts to recommit to the institutions, and have every conversation being about that. And framing it in those terms. I mean, that's how I feel. That is my absolute commitment. I have to stop thinking about, you know, each individual person and my animosity, but just say, look, there's really not. You know, people are angry, and I never want to talk to this person again. You need to commit to there being a Congress. You need to commit to there being a Supreme Court. You need to commit to there being a functional presidency.
And try to get a functional organization going here, guys.
Yeah,
let's try to figure out, stop your position and say, how do we make this work? Come on, let's make it work.
No, because the alternatives are, I mean, I think that people, we are taping this at an odd moment, but, you know, it may air after the election, but it'll go up on election day. That's kind of odd. I mean, the number of people, I'm here in California visiting from the East Coast. I'm taking more taxis than I've taken, you know, usually I don't take quite as many taxis as I'm taking just being on this book tour, and the number of taxi drivers. So I say, oh, so how's it in your state? How's it going here? The number of people saying, I just can't wait for it to be over. I just can't wait for it to be over. I can't wait for it to be over. And you see this fantasy that it'll be over and they won't have to think about this anymore. And I think, it'll be over. And then we need to start to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And I think then we'll have to reclaim political conversation. I mean, then you have to start to learn to talk to each other, because what this election has shown is that we don't know how. And we've shown little interest in learning how.
And I think one thing that we're doing justice to your book in the sense that it covers all these levels of relationship and conversation, but not there's so much more in the book. But one thing I want to bring up that is in the book as is the idea of children and emotional attachments and their life with all the technology around and even the smart toys. Michelle Obama stood and said, I fear when the television comes on, just when I turn it on for what my children will see. Her children are getting older even. We have children of all ages now who are – the television is on. who is saying what? Was there ever a time that we can say, now, kids, we're going to watch the presidential debates, and you have to make them sit there and watch. It's good for you. And now it's like, no, this is way out of your league. I mean, do we have any sense of what the impact of both the general, all the changes that have happened with all of this technology around them in terms of the internet and this election cycle? Do we have any sense for what that impact is on our children?
Well, one of the things we have in my book, I focus on something that that I think is the most crucial effect of the new media culture on children, which is an assault on empathy. The best studies show that there's been that in the course of the past 30 years, there's been a 40% decline in all the ways we know how to measure empathy, those studies among college students. So empathy here is being defined as, in really the simplest ways, as my ability, if I'm shown a story, to just say, what are the people in the story feeling? And that's a scary number. And actually, I spoke with the woman who had directed that group of studies, and she said that after she finished that, and of course it was reported in the New York Times, and it was a very big study, she said she started designing empathy apps for the iPhone because it was so depressing. And I think that issue of that technology got us into a problem, because most of the decline was in the past 10 years, and so it was attributed to the presence of digital devices, because you get empathy by looking at people, and if everybody's looking down at a phone, you're not getting that to happen. And she talked about these empathy apps, and I thought, we are the empathy app. Talking amongst ourselves is the empathy app, and this idea that children were going to be sitting in classrooms practicing empathy on their iPhones instead of talking with each other.
Yes,
as you were talking
right here.
Yeah, exactly, because in you're teaching your kids how to apologize, that those conversations were the empathy app. So I think that in generalizing that perspective of mine, that we are the empathy app, conversation is the empathy app. I like to say that conversation is the talking cure. To generalize that to your question about, you know, what about looking at, well, the elections, what about looking at the debates? I think that basically children need to be, I mean, I don't know at what age, but, you know, children need to be told and understand that this is kind of where we are. Because when they go online, that is what they meet. I just was told about a university that had a Model Congress program. And, you know, all the people at the university, students at the university, took this as a two-year activity of setting up committees. And the students at the university were on them and practiced and had, you know, bills were going through. And then the way this Model Congress program then manifested itself and came to fruition is that high school students were brought in for a weekend to then participate in it. And for the high school students, this was a fantastic way to meet these college students, but then also it was on their, you know, their high school records as a college thing. I mean, it was a very, very big deal. And when they got to the point where they brought in the high school students, they used there's a program called Yik Yak, which creates a sort of chat environment in your local physical surround. Uh-huh. So that everybody in this studio, in this building, could be on Yik Yak and anonymously make comments about each other.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. So it's just it takes the physical location of your building or, you know, sort of, in this case, it took everybody who was participating in this Model Congress, gave them a channel. And anonymously, all the participants were able to make comments. And the comments were lewd, and the comments were destructive, and about the body parts of the college students, and about the body parts of the high school students, and what people wanted to do with the body parts of the different participants. And it was horrible, and it broke down. You know, here are these earnest college students coming to work with these high school students. and it completely
destroyed it.
Destroyed it. So to say, oh my God, you know, what to show to my children because they'll see on the presidential debate something that will rock them, they are meeting the vulgarity of what is unleashed when people are anonymous. That's what I said about the – they are meeting this in their everyday life. And what you need to talk to your kids about is how – that's what I meant when I said that the internet had invaded how we behave when we're anonymous on the internet has invaded our public discourse. It's not kind of – it's kind of gone that way. And I think that really what we need to do is to involve our children more in a much broader conversation.
A reality check.
A reality check on how we talk to each other, which I don't think parents have stepped up to. Because my reclaiming conversation is filled with stories of parents who'd rather talk on the internet to their children rather than face them face to face. So I think that it's the parental generation, they too have stepped back from...
And they got to step up.
They've got to step up. It's time to step up. I think we've let this technology kind of, with its convenience and its, oh, no, it's so convenient and I don't have to really deal with you. And maybe,
I have 2 seconds, so I'll go right to my little text or my
exactly. Maybe we once had a fight or maybe we once didn't this or once didn't that. Now we can really step up.
Well, Sherry, of course, I could talk to you for 3 more days.
This has
been
fun.
We're both busy, you
know.
We're
busy. We'll just have to text.
Absolutely. I'll text you on that.
I'll text you on that.
Please come back, and we'll continue many conversations.
I'd love that. It's always wonderful.
Thank you. My guest today is Dr. Sherry Turkle. Her book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. It's published by Penguin Press. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, diagnosing some behavioral problems and mental disorders in the pediatric area by identifying problems with the immune system. Dr. Craig Shimasaki is the CEO of Moleculera Labs.
Yeah, Moira, that's exactly what we see. These symptoms, whether it's obsessive compulsive disorders or motor tics or vocal tics or anxiety or rage, these are all neuropsychiatric symptoms that sometimes have different causes. And one of them is the immune system that's attacking the brain and producing these. But the problem really is the treatment of these as symptoms with neuropsych drugs versus treating the underlying immune system that's causing these symptoms.
Why would the immune system actually get connected all the way over to behavior? How could that be?
Yeah, that's really the interesting phenomenon, and it really does occur, but it's through this mechanism called molecular mimicry, which is what we named the company for, is that you have these 24 letters of the alphabet for protein, and some of them are identical to bacteria and viruses and fungus. And when the immune system sees it, it doesn't know whether it's making it against itself or against the invading organism. But normal healthy immune systems will say, don't make these anymore. But something goes a little haywire, and then it begins attacking our own self, kind of like friendly fire in a war. We can't tell the difference between the good guys and the bad guys. And when it attacks our joints, we call it rheumatoid arthritis. When it attacks our liver, we call it something else. When it attacks our thyroid, we call it Hashimoto's. But when it attacks the brain, we call it mental illness. And we don't consider that this is an underlying mechanism that can be really widespread.
How do we diagnose such things? You're looking at behavior. That seems to be the apparent problem.
Exactly. And this is probably the biggest issue, is because you can't look at an individual and say that's the result of immune system dysfunction versus genetics. We actually had a child, many of them, who came in with diagnosis of autism because they had these neuropsychiatric and motor behaviors. We tested them, in fact, this one child, and they're very highly positive in one of the 5 assays. They got treated for the immune system, and they no longer have autism anymore. And so this is really the evidence.
There's a whole lot of ears out there saying, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait, 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 wait. Craig.
Yes.
Dr. Shimasaki, say that again. What happened when?
Yes. And it's not to say that all autism or all ADD or all ADHD or even things like schizophrenia, bipolar, chronic depression are underlying immune. But we believe that a very big portion are, and that if it's properly treated, they don't stay on psychotropic drugs for the rest of their life. They actually get treated for the immune system, and they no longer have these symptoms.
So frequently we're looking at symptoms which are behavioral or if they're not behavioral, they're experiences such as depression, mm-hmm. anything that's psychological, and we're saying, okay, let's treat that directly. We can't see by looking at that. What's underlying it?
Yes.
What's underlying
yes.
it?
Yes. So the process that goes on, at least what we know and has been published, is that when we have an invading organism because something triggers it, and sometimes it could be environmental, we make antibodies. And then these antibodies may cross-react with different parts of our body. And if they cross-react with our brain, they produce different neuropsychiatric symptoms. In fact, half of epilepsy, and it's a motor movement condition, is underlying autoimmune. And so what we do is we have a panel of five tests to see if any of these individuals from their blood have these antibodies directed against parts of their brain. And if so, then the connection between their symptoms and the underlying autoimmune system needs to be treated.
Now, what do you look at in that blood?
Yes. So that's a little bit more complicated, but there's five different tests. And two of them have to do with these receptors in our brain called dopamine D1 and D2. And those two receptors are involved in the way we think, our movement, the things that control our cognition. And so if antibodies are attacking them or stimulating them, you can actually produce electronic or electrical impulses that could be unwanted and cause these symptoms. And then the other two tests are similar, but they involve the myelin sheath around the peripheral nerves. And this is really the target for multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, myasthenia gravis. And when it attacks the underlying myelin sheath, you get this interruption in the ability to conduct these electronic signals.
Once a medical professional can detect that there are these problems in the autoimmune system, is there anything that can be done?
Yes. In fact, this is really the good part of it because we can direct therapy towards the immune system versus these psychotropic drugs. And so often that these psychotropic drugs will have side effects, but the underlying treatment, which would be immune modulators, one of them can be intravenous immunoglobulin. Another is plasmapheresis. That's kind of like dialysis for the immune system. Sometimes as simple as steroids. And then even maybe dealing with the underlying infection that's triggering it.
Is this covered by insurance? Do people know about this?
It is covered by insurance. In fact, we bill on behalf of the patient. And there are what we call CPT codes that allow the ability to bill for it and reimburse it. The key really is getting the awareness to the parents and the physicians so that they're actually looking for it. And I'll give you one example. Chris Christopherson recently found out that he doesn't have Alzheimer's. It was believed that he had Alzheimer's or dementia because he was losing his memory and having difficulty with really cognition. Well, they did a test and found out he had Lyme disease. They treated the Lyme, which was the underlying root infection, and his memory and his cognition have come back. And this is really the importance of a diagnostic that will determine what therapy, because Lyme, influenza, Coxsackie virus, strep can all trigger this type of autoimmune condition to attack the brain.
So while we're talking about this pediatric panel, it's also open to adults?
It is. Right now we test about 30% are adults or people over 21. We find a lot of them, though, are just individuals who these occurred in their adolescent years and they've lived with it for the majority of their life. And psychotropic drugs have been sort of helping them to cope. I had one adult who was a professional said that after she got tested and treated, I never really knew what it was like to feel normal. And so you kind of get accustomed to a certain behavior and you just learn to cope with it. And we find that that's not necessarily the case. You have to do that.
How new is this panel of tests that you're running?
It's only 2 years old, and we brought it out of the University of Oklahoma from Dr. Madeline Cunningham's lab. And it is something that we believe is just sort of the tip of the iceberg that many of these other what we call neuropsychiatric or psychiatric neurological conditions may indeed, including Parkinson's and possibly Alzheimer's, may have this underlying autoimmune trigger that begins this process that causes these symptoms.
You know, we've heard such good news in the last year or so about, oh my goodness, we understand cancer and the immune system and we're using it to go after cancer. Mm-hmm. That means we're learning a lot about the immune system.
Precisely.
And what its role is.
Yes.
So why it wouldn't be involved in a whole lot of things, not just curing cancer.
Exactly. It's one of the most powerful systems in our body. And if we think about it, it can, which is why immunotherapy for cancer works, is because we train the immune system to go against the foreign invaders or the non-self. But if it doesn't recognize it and it sees ourself as being the foreign invader, it's very difficult to actually do something to help improve that without treating the immune system.
So you don't have to go to Oklahoma City to get this, right?
No, actually, we have physicians in about 49 states that are currently testing, and then 30% come from out of the country because we're the only clinical lab in the world that does this. But I might add that the initial insult that occurs is generally multiple rounds of infections. So you will see either these children that have had histories or have a predisposed to an infection and maybe multiple infections. And then somewhere along the line, they will start developing these neuropsychiatric symptoms. Maybe Johnny has this strange behavior. He didn't have it before. He's not concentrating. Then he has these obsessions and fears. And then they're off trying to find out, how do we deal with that? But it's triggered by an infection. And then the immune system takes over. And what happens is it begins attacking our brain.
So for those cases where that is the case, we want to know about it.
Exactly.
Well, Craig, thank you so much. Please come back. Keep us updated.
It's been a pleasure, Moira. Thank you.
Dr. Craig Shimasaki is the CEO of Moleculera Labs. More information is available at moleculeralabs.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.